Yeah. All right. Going to call this meeting the Conference Committee on Senate File 2909 to order. We do have a quorum present. We got more people in the audience today. We'll just remind folks the acoustics in this room. You might think you're whispering, but I can probably hear you. So use your phones and text each other instead of whispering, and that will help all of us hear the testimony that we're going to hear today. The chairs have been meeting. Full transparency, the chairs have been meeting quite a bit. We are making some good progress. We're going to take some testimony today on some things that we don't have final language yet on, and I thought it would be helpful to take some testimony. So that's what we're going to do first today. So the first group of testimony is going to be on the no-knock search warrant provisions. Committee members, you should have a copy of the most recent draft of the proposal in your packets. We also just posted that online for the public to reference as well. We'll not be taking a vote on that this morning, but that's the proposal that's out there. And Chair Moeller, or I guess Representative Curran, if you can speak to the work that's been done and sort of maybe where the changes are from last time we had a public hearing on this.
Sure. Go ahead. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Moeller, too, as well, for the work that we've done on this. So since the last time this was before us, we've had a chance to meet with some additional groups. We've talked with MPPOA and the chiefs and sheriffs to go over some language. And if we look at the draft of the no-knock provision, we've added some language that is consistent with case law. That we feel will make things a little bit more clear. So that would be objectively reasonable amount of time based on totality of circumstances. And then if we look in the application section of the no-knock warrant, we added that in the application process, we would like to have presented to the judge the known or suspected occupants of the place to be searched, who we expect or anticipate to be in there to the best of our knowledge, and whether or not any of those occupants are under the age of 18. There's no direction on what to do if someone is there under the age of 18. It's merely just there to make sure that we note for the judge so they have a full picture of what that situation might be when somebody goes in. And I think that is essentially the changes we had from last time, Chair Moeller. I'm Chair, if I don't have anything to add.
Anything additional, Chair Moeller?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Curran. We did make some additional changes. The bill that passed off the House floor, we had a pretty narrow exception drawn to the complete ban, and then we got stakeholder feedback and then really sort of, I would say, wordsmithed that language to make it clearer than what was passed off the House floor. So that would be subdivision 2A of the bill. The goal and the intent was always the same with how it was crafted, but we just worked on the language a little bit.
All right. Any further member discussion on this? Otherwise, I'm going to go to public testimony. All right. Let's see. I've got Chief Kelly McCarthy. Oh, they are here. I can never see through the tall backs of the chairs to tell who's in the first rows. So welcome to the committee, Chief. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, ma'am, and thank you so much for having me here. I love testifying at these because it's like when you were little and the people from Fantasy Island would be on Love Boat, like those crossovers. So it's very exciting for me. My name is Kelly McCarthy, and I'm the current chief of the Mendota Heights Police Department. And I'm here today to just really encourage you to limit, preferably ban, the use of no-knock warrants. This topic is one that I'm very passionate about, and I think there's some real ground to cover here because everybody who talks about no-knock warrants wants the same thing, which is to save lives. We just are going about it a different way. I have written no-knock search warrants. I have served no-knock search warrants. I will not do that going forward because I now know better. I know there's a better way to save lives. And don't take my word for it. I'm just a big dumb cop in a small suburb. But listen to the National Tactical Officers Association and the statement that they put out, which is that the use of no-knock warrants is counterintuitive, and it puts the public and officers at risk. These are the experts in the field. These aren't people who are telling you how it used to be done. They're the ones who are doing it going forward, and they're telling you to ban no-knock warrants. So they will tell you that it will save lives. And not only do they talk about safety, but they actually put action behind their words. And you can imagine tactical officers were a little bit displeased when their association put restraints or came out and told them, what you're doing is dumb. So what they did is they brought their executive director and their head of training to our statewide tactical officers association, and they trained our tactical units in a better way to do these, which does not include no-knock warrants. So we know better. Please, let's do better. Let's save the lives of our constituents and of our officers. And of course, I just want to make sure I don't have any else with my notes. And I think that's it. So if there's any questions, I will of course stand for them. If not, thank you so much to everybody for all the work that you do.
Any member questions for Chief McCarthy? I'm sure they will stick around after we have the other testimony. If there are questions, we can always come back to you. All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Commander Tim Flynn.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Commander. And if you pull the mic so it's more on the same level as your mouth, we will be able to pick up what you say even better. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Tim Flynn, Commander of St. Paul Police Department. I've been a police officer for 30 years, been a commander for 17, and commander of the St. Paul SWAT team for the last 16 years. I was asked to come here to speak to you all about our tactics for the St. Paul Police Department. I don't want to speak for other teams. I don't necessarily want to speak for out-of-city jurisdictions. Privilege in St. Paul to have the numbers and the resources and the equipment to perform search warrants, to serve search warrants the way that we do. Out-of-city agencies, up-north agencies, smaller suburbs do not have the equipment or the resources that we have to conduct and serve warrants. So I'll speak to how St. Paul serves warrants. Back in 2013, I had the privilege of going out and observing Oakland SWAT team and how they conducted business and how they served warrants. This was after they lost four police officers in a matter of 2 hours on a traffic stop situation that then resulted in a search warrant. And what they did at that time was commonly referred to as a surround and call out. And it takes a lot of resources, a lot of time, a lot of equipment to do so. They were under a national consent decree, and that's why they conducted their business that way. I came back to St. Paul in 2013 and started moving towards the surround and call out way of serving warrants. And I got a lot of pushback from our team. Everyone thought I was crazy and I was soft, and why am I conducting business that way? As the chief alluded to earlier, our goal is to take people into custody with the least amount of force possible, with the least amount of damage to property as possible. So how we approach a warrant is we set up on that address, we contain the inner perimeter of that address, and then we'll start announcing over a system called a long-range acoustical device to let the people know inside that address who we are, the authority that we have to be there, it being a search warrant for the address as well as sometimes an arrest warrant for the suspects inside. We make several announcements. The timeline could be anywhere from 2 minutes to 5 minutes depending on who answers that door and who comes out to us. Our goal is to get them to come to us, take them into custody. This is all recorded on our body-worn camera devices. We don't want there to be any confusion on whether or not the people inside of that residence knew who we were and what authority we had to be there in doing so. We do still train dynamic entry, and the purpose that we train our dynamic entry for would be a life-saving measure for a hostage rescue type situation. And if we were ever in that type of situation, we would not need a warrant to make entry to save someone's life. It would be an exigent circumstance. That's why we continue to train at that speed in order to save someone's life. But since 2016, we have, as a SWAT team in St. Paul, have not served a no-knock search warrant in a dynamic entry speed. There could be a couple warrants that someone might bring to my attention that it may have been written as a no-knock, but we do not serve them at that speed. And again, that's been since 2016. If you want me to go into further detail about the progression on how we serve our warrants and take people into custody, I'd be happy to do so.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your service. Members, any questions for Commander? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commander, for being here today. I'm a St. Paul legislator, so I appreciate you being here, my colleague here. Could you just tell us then, have you been able to do any kind of comparison in terms of, you know, lives that were lost or injuries that happened before 2016 and after? And also, other than that, what you mentioned is kind of surrounding the place. What other strategies are you using?
Commander.
Thank you, Senator. So I have not done a comparison. You mean within our team, St. Paul alone? Comparison
within St. Paul.
Our no-knock entry versus. So in the time I've been a commander of the SWAT team, I believe we've got into one lethal engagement. That was in 2014, I believe, on the east side. And that was a situation where that individual was out and about in his backyard in the alley wearing a full tactical vest with an AR-15 rifle. In that situation, we attempted to negotiate. There was no doubt that person knew who we were at the time we were there. That person was armed, and our officers were found to be justified in that lethal engagement. Other than that, on our no-knock entries prior to 2016, none of them that I'm aware of resulted in a lethal engagement for a St. Paul SWAT entry of a search warrant. Now, if you remember back before recently, a lot of teams other than St. Paul SWAT were serving search warrants. A lot of investigative units were serving search warrants. A lot of drug units were serving search warrants. At that time, our force unit, which was focusing our resources on community empowerment, which was a street-level narcotic enforcement unit, was serving search warrants. About approximately 2.5 years ago, all search warrants served in the city of St. Paul are served by St. Paul SWAT personnel. And the reason for that is our team trains every 3 weeks. We train together. We know each other's movements. I would consider them the best tactical officers in our city. And we don't want to leave a chance if an investigative unit, such as the previous units I mentioned, were to serve a warrant and they don't have time to train together and they don't have the decision-making capabilities that our SWAT team does. So we've taken every measure, again, with the end goal to take people into custody with the least amount of force possible and the least amount of damage possible. So we've taken control of the situation so that we get our trained personnel to serve those warrants. Now, your second question about tactics and the prolonged progression of an event and what gives us St. Paul the advantage over maybe some outlying suburban departments that don't have the same equipment. So I'll give you a for instance. If we set up on a house and we start to make announcements over the long range acoustical device and we don't get any response back, usually in a case we have a phone number for the suspect or suspects that are inside the residence. As you probably know, in your own home, landlines are a thing of the past, so it's all done by cell phones. So we bring with us, it's not just the SWAT team we bring with us, we bring our ordnance disposal unit because they have all of our robots. We bring our negotiators with us because they have been trained in, have the ability to talk to people to get them to do what we want them to do with the ultimate goal to come out to us so we can take them into custody. So if there's no response over the long-range acoustical device, and sometimes there is, sometimes within 30 seconds they'll open the door and they'll all come out. There's no response, I'll advise our tactical negotiators to call the cell phone to then go through the same progression. This is the St. Paul Police Department. We have a search warrant for your home. All occupants of your home are to come out the front door with your hands up, nothing in your hands. Come to the back of the green truck. And that's what they say over the cell phone. Say there's, and that has been successful. If that's not successful, we still don't get any movement from the inside of the house. I'll instruct one of our team leaders to go up and breach the door. Now keep in mind, we've probably been there at a minimum 5 minutes, but we're usually there 15, 20, 25 minutes. The whole neighborhood knows we're there because we continue announcements over this loudspeaker. So I'll have a team leader go up and breach the door. Breach the door, that sometimes, if they couldn't hear us because the door was breached, we'll breach that door and we'll continue announcements through there. If it's conducive to introduce a robot, we will introduce a robot, and that robot is on track. It's a small-looking robot that is on tracks, and that has video capability and audio capability to move through the address and clear as much of the address as we can. Again, my goal is to do everything we possibly can before I put a human into the situation, which is going to put them in danger, and I want to try to get the person to give up and come out to us as safely as possible. So the progression would be the loudspeaker, the negotiators over cell phone, breach the door, put a robot in. If a robot's gotten to the point where we can't go any further, then we possibly will enter a police canine. Now the canine will be on a lead and the canine will be announcements. Again, there's no confusion of who we are and why we're there. So multiple announcements before that canine is inserted and is inserted as a location device to see if there's any possible people on the inside. Again, multiple announcements, who we are, why we're there, announcement, it's a risk to you. If we send the dog in to search, that dog may locate you and you may be bitten. So eventually we're going to have to put personnel in there to search things. So again, this could be half an hour, this could be an hour into the incident. We high probability that the person is still in there. We need to clear and secure that address so investigators come in and search that address. The last thing we want is for an investigator to be searching for evidence of a crime and all of a sudden someone is hiding in a closet and they pop out, and that's not fair to that investigator, nor is it safe for that investigator. Our goal as a SWAT team is to secure and make that address safe. Whoever is inside to detain or take them into custody with the least amount of force possible, with the least amount of damage, and preserve that scene and make that scene safe so that investigators can then move in and search the address.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome, Senator.
Senator Umu Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for being here, Commander Flynn. I really appreciate you taking the time out of, I'm sure, your busy schedule to be with us. I also am a St. Paul legislator, and I just want to, again, thank the St. Paul Police Department for all the work that you've been doing, not using these no-knock warrants since 2016. I know I've spoken with Mayor Carter about how the instances of canine bites have also gone down recently, that you've been really responsible with how you use those, and that we have some of the highest clearance rates in the country. So I think we have a lot of confidence in our department with these changes that have been made. But some of the arguments that we've heard against this are around protecting and preserving evidence. So I'm just wondering if you can speak to that, since you have not been using or significantly limiting no-knock warrants. You know, has that presented any challenges with preserving evidence?
So I can Commander, my experience and how we do things in St. Paul. Now, the aforementioned force unit, Madam Senator, focusing our resources on community empowerment was a street-level narcotics unit. I served in that unit, and this is back when crack houses populated a lot of the areas of the city of St. Paul. And our goal is to preserve evidence. And we were serving the warrants at that time. As a SWAT team, again, our goal, as I mentioned earlier, is to make that scene safe so investigators can serve their warrant. We are not an evidence collection team. In regards to evidence, firearms, yes, I'm primarily concerned with firearms. You can't really stow or flush a firearm. Narcotics, our team is not an evidence recovery team. Now, is that frustrating to other detectives within our department? It is. But again, my goal is the safety of my personnel that are going into the address and the safety of the people that we are trying to take into custody. So our team is not to be used for evidence recovery. And as I stated earlier, about 2.5 years ago, our city moved towards only SWAT personnel are to serve these search warrants. So I can speak for the city of St. Paul that the speed to recover evidence is not a concern of mine.
Any follow-up, Senator? All right. Any further questions for Commander Flynn? All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer our questions and for your service.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up on the list, I have Chief Jeff Potts. I don't know if you're – are you testifying with – okay.
Sure.
Sheriff Leslie. Welcome to Conference Committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Thanks, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Jeff Potts, Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I represent the roughly 305 police chiefs in the state of Minnesota. And I'll just make some opening remarks and then I'll turn to Sheriff Leslie. As the chair mentioned, we had a really good conversation with the author, Representative Rand, Chair Moeller, stakeholder group, which consisted of the MPPOA, the Sheriff's Association, and of course the Minnesota Chiefs Association. I'm referring to a document that Chair Moeller, I was sent that I think the line numbers match what you have in front of you. And so we had really good conversation about no-knock warrants. I think the group brought forward some suggestions as to try to, I guess, preserve a very narrow set of circumstances, and that would be the most dangerous of dangerous and recognizing what Commander Flynn and Chief McCarthy said, that we agree that there is definitely a trend from a tactical perspective to move away from what's called a dynamic entry. But I guess it is our association's perspective that there is still a very narrow set where a no-knock warrant may be appropriate and may actually be a safe alternative than other considered alternatives. So that means that line 1.8, we talked with the group about this, the search cannot be executed while the premises is unoccupied. That means that the person or persons that that we're looking for are located actually inside the premises. Line 1.9, the occupant or occupants in the premises present an imminent threat of death or great bodily harm to the officers executing the warrant or other persons. We agreed that that would become essentially that very narrow set considerations where a no-knock warrant could be applied for to a judge. Ultimately, that judge makes the decision. Madam Chair, the part that I think we're having some concern with is under the definition section, which starts on line 1.5. Now, this definition really lays out the difference between a no-knock warrant and what we'll consider a knock and announce or regular warrant service. There's a very big difference between no-knock warrants and a knock and announce warrant. The line that, and we agreed that, you know, that knocking is probably not required, so the word knocking was struck, loudly and understandably announcing the officer's presence or purpose and waiting an objectively reasonable amount of time thereafter based on a totality of circumstances prior to entering the premises. See, that is that would be the standard for not a no-knock warrant. I want to make sure that the entire committee understands that. We're not talking about no-knock warrants anymore under that definition section. We're talking about a knock and announce warrant. The line that we have an issue with is the second portion of line 1.9, which is to allow the subject to become alert and able to comply. Now, no-knock and knock and announce warrants have well-established case law. Hudson versus Michigan, Wilson versus Arkansas, Richardson versus Wisconsin, U.S. versus Banks, which actually contemplates how long officers must wait. In that case, Banks was in the shower at the time of the knock and announce warrant. The officers knocked, announced, waited 15 to 20 seconds. Banks was in the shower, didn't hear it. Supreme Court said that's actually not long enough. That's one case that starts to give us an idea of what is the reasonable amount of time, and they've landed somewhere around that 30-second time period. U.S. versus Thompson also talks about when and how long officers must wait. By adding to allow the subject to become alert and able to comply is difficult for us to interpret. I can't answer how long that is. I think it's going to differ from one situation to the next, and I think perhaps could put the officers who are on the other side of that door who don't know what is going on the inside in a position where they may second guess themselves. I'm concerned about that piece because I think it makes that service of a knock and announce warrant actually more dangerous. The rest of the changes, Madam Chair, that were talked about and included in this amendment, our association is fine with, but we do have an objection to that one section that really doesn't have anything to do with no-knock warrants. It's really about knock and announce warrants. Madam Chair, I'll end my comments at this point and turn over to Sheriff Leslie.
All right. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Tim Leslie, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, retired sheriff in Dakota County. Spent 42 plus years in law enforcement. I don't share much with Commander Flynn. Other than the fact that I was the SWAT commander in St. Paul for many years as well. So I appreciate his testimony, and we agree in for the most part with Chief McCarthy and with Commander Flynn's testimonies that you've heard, as well as we align with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We do want to thank Chair Moeller, Representative Perron, for the opportunity to engage with them about our concerns over the bill. The concern over the bill is exactly what Jeff Potts spent time on. That line, to allow the subject to become alert and able to comply, is our concern, because we earlier enter into the objective reasonableness. We add that in the totality of circumstances, which is an objective standard that has much case law behind it, and now we enter something that's totally subjective. And so it kind of negates, in our opinion, the objective reasonableness standard by offering this other thing that we have no standard of. We don't know what subject to become alert and able to comply even means. And so then that'll have to be sorted out and questioned, and the judges will decide. We put the whole police officer thing in jeopardy then, is they're not determined or know what they're going to do next. So we kind of line with never say never, never say always with these warrants. We'd like to capture just that small area where we could use these in circumstances we may not have thought of yet or encountered, frankly. Give the police officers a little bit of room. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to all the testifiers. And I do have a couple of questions, but before I get to those, I just want to acknowledge the tragic loss of life of another officer in a neighboring jurisdiction due to gun violence. So just wanted to name that first. So one of the things that we heard from Commander Flynn relates to equipment and resources. And that they may have different equipment and resources in St. Paul that other jurisdictions don't have. And I don't know if this is as much a question or just a comment. Like, if jurisdictions need these tools like robots to be able to do these types of entries that are safer for everybody, like, please come to the legislature and ask for equipment to do that. That is exactly the kind of thing, and I'm seeing a lot of head nods, that we need to know about if agencies are under-resourced to be able to do these safely. So please come back with that request sometime, and we'd be glad to have a hearing on that. I do have a question about the language that's an issue, and again, thank you so much for your work on trying to craft this language and narrow the language, and really appreciate that. So with line 1.9, and I do appreciate, Chief Potts, that you explained that this is really worded in a negative, so it's confusing. So thank you for clarity around what we're doing here. And I think from our perspective that line, to allow the subject to become alert and able to comply, was meant to also be an objective standard. I don't think that was anybody's intent that was subjective. And I guess, based on my reading of the case law, if you're talking about waiting an objectively reasonable amount of time thereafter based on a totality of the circumstances prior to entering the premises for what, and that's to allow compliance. I mean, that's sort of the underlying theme of the case law and talking about what's reasonable under the circumstances with the timelines. So I guess my question for you is, if we struck out that word become alert, does that cause you to still be concerned, or if it just said prior to entering the premises to allow the subject to be able to comply, would that alleviate some of your concerns? And I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. Like, I'm genuinely trying to figure out is there another way to craft that recognizes what our intent is and addresses your concerns?
Chief Potts or Sheriff Leslie?
Madam Chair, Chair Moeller, I'll try to answer that. It's a little bit of a difficult question. I think if you're asking us if we would be comfortable, or what we would be comfortable with, and again, I'm now speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, I think our preference, quite frankly, would be to put the period after the word premises. And I say that because whether it's to allow them to become alert or able to comply, while that may be the goal in every warrant that we serve, law enforcement serves, everybody wants the police officers to go home safely. Everybody wants the occupants of the premises to stay safe. What gets really difficult for the people executing that search warrant is, and that's why the case law is a little bit, it's hard to track sometimes. And U.S. versus Thompson versus U.S. versus, I believe it's Hudson, where they're trying to really define what is that reasonable amount of time and the purpose for waiting for that time. Ideally, it is for them to comply and answer the door and everything goes smooth. But when that doesn't happen, and while the police officers are waiting on the other side of the door not knowing what is happening, that's where we start to have a little bit of difficulty going beyond the language that says that they have an objectively reasonable amount of time based on the totality of the circumstances. Again, I'll reiterate what I said in the opening remarks, that I worry that officers waiting and second guessing while there is no intention to comply on the other side of the door, what they might be going into. And so trying to put additional language on, you know, waiting for them to comply or waiting for them to become alert, I think adds even more complexity to an already complex decision that is going to have to be made as to when they enter that premises. So if you're asking for like what would we be comfortable with, I think adding the objectively reasonable amount of time language, our preference would be to put the period after the word premises.
All right. Sheriff Leslie.
Madam Chair and Chair Mueller, I would agree with that. And I would just add that alert and able to both are, to me, on a sliding scale of what, you know, my alert might be different than your alert. 2 cups of coffee, 3 cups of coffee, great. And then the objective reasonable standard also includes the not with 20/20 vision or hindsight. And I'm afraid you're going to enter into 20/20 vision and hindsight into the alert and able to comply standard, where now we're looking backwards, which is not allowed in the objective reasonableness standard.
So thank you. As listening carefully and trying to figure out how to make this work, and again, like putting you on the spot, but in a good way. This is what happens when you do a conference committee out in the open and actually try to figure stuff out. If we put the period after the word premises, but on line 1.8 added after the word thereafter wrote to comply. This is sort of you're waiting an objectively reasonable amount of time for what? And so I think that's why that language was added on line 1.9 to kind of clarify what you're waiting for.
So where?
Yep. Chair, yep.
Where
so
would you add to comply?
After the word thereafter. So it would read, and waiting an objectively reasonable amount of time thereafter to comply based on the totality of the circumstances prior to entering the premises.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, is that a question? Like, would we?
What do you think about that?
I think
does that make it better? You don't have to love it, but does it make it better? Chief Potts.
I don't love it. I'm sorry. I think the word comply for us adds an element of, I'll say that is the goal. And Commander Flynn and Chief McCarthy made really good points on, especially relative to no-knocks. I think I would rather rely on case law to decide or determine what is that reasonable amount of time and what case law tells us. It's the totality of the circumstances. It is a whole bunch of things that are being considered, and the word comply to me means that if they didn't wait long enough, perhaps, that now we're in a situation where there's going to be a challenge and that evidence could be suppressed. In the era of body cameras, while the officers wait 35 seconds and someone inside was just not quick enough to comply, are we now subjecting that case and whatever may be seized? And I'm not trying to add a whole lot to, collection of evidence is the reason to speed this up. I'm just trying to be practical here, and however long they wait with this, the word comply, and then what may be captured on video later, where there may or may not, have video evidence that shows that the person was walking to the door or they were maybe on the way to complying. I'm concerned, but I'm really more concerned about the officer second guessing themselves and waiting in a situation where somebody may not have any intention of complying and the dangers that come with that. That's where the biggest concern I have with adding that word comply. While I agree that should be the goal, been talked about by other testifiers, I'm worried about when that's not actually happening and what the consequence to waiting that additional time might be to everybody involved.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right, well, we're still working. But I hope that like the public and you all find this helpful, because I think it is helpful. We're all trying to get to the the best place we can be, even if none of us love it. So thank you for your testimony. We do have one more testifier. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer my thoughts. Having listened to this, and I think that the chiefs and the sheriff make a compelling point. When you're in a situation like that, on the other side, I mean, what I'm hearing is the object is for the subject to comply, but it has, we have to defer, I think, to the expertise of the folks that are doing this work of, you know, what is an objectively reasonable amount of time, and having considered the totality of the circumstances. I guess with that said, I'm inclined to agree with them that a period after the word premises would probably be the most workable option.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? All right. Thank you very much. We do have one more testifier. We've got Andre Locke. Welcome, Mr. Locke. I know it's not easy to keep coming back and sharing this with us, but I really do appreciate that you're able to come in again to our committee and really appreciate your perspective. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
I am Andre Locke, the father of Amir Locke. Thank you, Chair Mueller, to the committee. Thank you for having me again. It is overwhelming, I have to be honest. It's extremely overwhelming to come and continue to humanize my son. So, I come from a patriotic family of law enforcement and family members that serve in the military and that are still active. My father, each of his brothers, 80 years old, still alive to this day. A POW as well in Vietnam. To see what they went through and to see where we are at this point. Thank you again for this opportunity. My son Amir mattered. He was 22 years old and was laying the groundwork for a meaningful life, helping make the world a better place. And now we have to try and do that in his name. He was a beautiful son and had a great sense of humor and loved music and had an unforgettable smile. He was truly loved. In the early morning hours of February the 2nd, 2022, a little more than a year ago, Amir was awoken by a no-knock warrant executed by the Minneapolis SWAT team. Amir was not named in that warrant, not suspected of any crimes, and was a guest in the residence where he slept. Upon being awoken by the invading SWAT team, Amir reached for his handgun, demonstrating proper and responsible handling by keeping the handgun pointed down, keeping his finger off of the trigger, and never raising the weapon in the direction of any officer. Minneapolis, without warning, and denying my son the ability to assess the situation and disarm himself, fired three times, while Amir was still covered in a blanket on the couch where he had been resting peacefully. Within 10 seconds, of the SWAT team entering the apartment, Amir was gone. No-knock warrants like the one that resulted in Amir's senseless death are an issue for Minnesota and our entire nation. And if I'm not mistaken, St. Paul has gone successfully without a no-knock warrant for 8 years. So why wouldn't it work for the entire state? We have the opportunity to make history in the state here by being the sixth state, if I'm not mistaken, for banning no-knock warrants and saving lives, not only civilians, but police officers as well. Representative Omar has introduced the Amir Locke no-knock warrants reform bill in Congress, and now these brave lawmakers of Minnesota are stepping up to do the right thing and save lives. Minnesota has a responsibility to its citizens to ensure police officers are properly trained and understand how to de-escalate interactions with civilians and value human life. This tragedy was avoidable if the city abided in its promise to cease performing these dangerous and unnecessary no-knock warrants. Shooting Amir under these circumstances without warning, without the opportunity to comply, is unreasonable force under the Fourth Amendment. My son Amir, our hearts are broken, and nothing is going to change that. And nothing is going to bring that back, but we have the opportunity to lay the groundwork for his legacy. Thank you for the opportunity. Our hearts go out to each of the officers of, that have lost their lives in the last few months, with being a part of a family that I apologize. Being a part of a family of law enforcement as well, our hearts go out to each of them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any discussion, additional discussion on the no-knock warrant provision? Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Mr. Locke so much for coming and sharing his story again. I know the members of the Senate didn't have an opportunity to hear from Mr. Locke, and so we really appreciate that. I know it's not easy to have to share your story so many times. But we're really grateful, and I think we're all really committed here to working on this issue. I did want to ask if Chief McCarthy is still here, if she could come back up to ask a few questions.
Yep. All right. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chief McCarthy. I just wanted to get your take. You know, I asked Commander Flynn about some of those concerns around preservation of evidence. I'm also curious if you had any suggestions around, you know, additional items to include in the application. We really wanted to specify, you know, known or suspected occupants in the premises, especially anyone who's under the age of 18. So do you have any recommendations there, and just your thoughts around, you know, sort of these exceptions?
Chief.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, ma'am. I don't know that I'm the best person to ask, because I don't think there should be exceptions. Mm-hmm. If you give us an exception, we are going to use it. Every warrant we conduct, there's a threat. And so police officers are great. If you give us a mission, we're going to achieve the mission. And maybe not always, we're going to be so focused on getting it done that we're going to look for a reason to use this exception. So I'm not the best person to speak on the wording for the exception, because I don't really understand why we would make an exception. We didn't say, and these are the things we're doing prior to the warrant. So they're not heat of the moment things. So we didn't say, officers, you will read Miranda unless. We didn't give us those things. We just said, hey, if they're in custody and you're questioning them about their own guilt, read them Miranda, no exceptions. So why we would have this, I'm not exactly sure, other than to maybe just a thin end of the wedge so we see that we can still police when there's no-knock warrants 5 years from now, and then we can get rid of the exception. I don't know. But I guess I'm not the best person to speak on that.
All right. Senator Umu-Verbaten, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
All right. All right, members, any further questions? Otherwise, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. All right, thank you very much to our testifiers. Again, I know it's hard to ask people to keep coming back to these rooms, but I do think it was important to get that on the record and have that before the Senate as well. So thank you especially to Mr. Locke for coming in again today. Next, changing gears here. So we're going to move on to some adoption of some outstanding policy, judiciary policy issues. Are we doing it as one? Okay. And just to make sure with staff, we can do it as one big motion with the listed items, or do you want us, is it easier for staff if we adopt them one by one?
Madam Chair, I think it's up to the chair which manner you'd like to proceed. You could do it going through the spreadsheet, or, I mean, going through the side-by-side with the specific sections, but I believe there should at least should be a table with the specific section numbers for each piece.
Got it.
Some of them have amendments, so it might be helpful to go by the subject matter. So those are just some suggestions for you.
Got it. I think because at least today we've only got five things in front of us, I think we will do them one by one just so we're all clear on what we're doing. Chair Latz, would you like to move adoption? We've got on R12 Senate language. So just for public's benefit, this is on the House File 447, Senate File 200 side-by-sides. R12 Senate language on Section 6, which is the consumer protection action in the public benefit, which is a Freiburg Senator Latz bill. Senator Latz, would you like to make that motion?
Madam Chair, I move adoption.
All right. Any discussion to that section? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That language is adopted. All right, the next one, Chair Latz, would you like to move on R21 and R22, Senate language on Section 7 and Section 9 with the amendment coded A9, and this is the survival of personal injury actions, which was a Representative Feist, Senator Latz bill. And Chair Latz, if you want to speak to the amendment and that provision and make that motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The underlying purpose of this bill was to ensure that a personal injury cause of action would remain a valid cause of action even if the person who was making the claim died while the action was pending from some cause other than the basis for that claim. It would thereby allow the estate of that person to continue to seek to hold the tortfeasor accountable even after the claimant passed away. Otherwise, if the action dies with the claimant, there is not only no longer a mechanism for holding a potential tortfeasor accountable, the person who caused or the organization that caused the injury, but also it would encourage the defendant or the recipient of that claim, it would create an incentive for them to delay resolving the claim, especially if they had some reason to believe that the death of the claimant was might possibly happen before the litigation or the claim could run out. So the goal here was to do that, and I think we are the only state left in the nation that has not done this. So we talk about being an outlier. Now there was some discussion relating to claims that arose in particular out of conduct by a healthcare provider during the course of the peacetime emergency from the COVID-19 pandemic. So because that was kind of a unique situation, there is an amendment, coded the A19 amendment, I'm sorry, the A9 amendment.
Actually, I'll just clarify too, because both of our amendments are A9s.
Oh.
So it's the SCS0200 A9 that we're moving on this piece.
Gotcha.
I don't know why we couldn't have figured out a different digit for the other amendment later on, but that's the amendment.
All right. So the underlying Senate bill was Senate File 200, which is where that came from.
Yep.
There's another Senate File 447, which was also involved in all of these proceedings, which is the other A9 or the House file there. So if you have the 200 A9, subdivision 2 is a special provision relating to statute of limitation for a claimant who died during the course of a or to be able to bring a claim relating to a COVID-19 allegation. And that highly unusual, but it provides for a statute of limitations of 1 year from the date of the death of the former patient or resident. Ordinarily, statute of limitations are much longer than that, but given the unusual circumstances under this of the pandemic, we felt this was appropriate. And this was stakeholders have had a lot of conversations about this, so that's resulted in this amendment.
All right, and to clarify, it's Chair Latz's motion that on R21 and R22, we would adopt the Senate language on Section 7 and 8 and Section 9 with the amendment that was just described. Any discussion to that
motion? So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Latz. Any discussion to that? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say how strongly I support this bill. Obviously, I carried it in the House. I think it's incredibly important, and just wanted to thank the stakeholders for really productive conversations to get this bill into a form that everyone could live with and would ensure that it achieves its very important goals. So thank you.
Chair Latz.
Madam Chair, I'll just add a thank you, Representative Feist, for carrying it. This has been around the legislature for many, many years. I was chief author of it a long time ago. Senator Dietzick became chief author of it as most recently as last session. And then with her taking on new responsibilities, I became the chief author again for this year. So we're glad to get this across the finish line.
All right, we've got the motion before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That language is adopted. Moving on, Chair Latz, would you like to move on page R27, adopting the Senate language on Section 7? This is regarding attorney access to MGA. Chair Latz.
Move adoption of Section 7 on page R27. Would you like me to explain the amendment?
Yes, please.
Provision?
Yes,
Madam
go
Chair.
Ahead.
Presently, Minnesota attorneys in private practice have access to the same court records documents through the judicial system that any other member of the public has. Not all records are accessible to members of the public, which means that attorneys, even on their own cases, don't have access through the court system to the documents, some of the documents in their own cases. On the other hand, prosecutors and public defenders do have access to those not public documents, they do so through a system called the Minnesota Government Access. So what this does is it allows for an attorney who's licensed to practice law in Minnesota to be able to apply for an account in the Minnesota Government Access system, or MGA. So that we'll have the same access that our opposing counsel has in criminal cases to all of the documents in the case.
All right. Any discussion to that provision? All right. Senator Westland.
As a family law attorney who has occasionally had people retain me after many things have been filed in court and they don't have copies, this would be awesome.
And Senator, I will say from the prosecution side, I've been on the phone call with other people and been like, why can't you see this thing? And then realizing that they have different access that we have. So I think the attorneys are on board with this language. All right. Chair Latz renews his motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The R27 language is adopted. Moving on, Chair Latz. I don't know if Chair Frazier want to move this one, or Representative Frazier want to move this one. On pages R29 and R30, adopt the House language in Section 24 with the amendment coded H0447A9. And this is the State Board of Public Defense membership increase. Representative Frazier, would you like to make that motion?
Madam Chair, we'll make that motion.
All right. And Representative Frazier, if you can just speak to this piece to remind members and the public what this provision is about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This provision was essentially about to expand the Board of Public Defense, and the reason being was to include members that are close to the situation, to add two more public members, and one of those members would be an individual that has practiced within the last 5 years as a public defender.
All right. And then the amendment, essentially, I know some of the discussion in
and that this is a House provision. Some of the discussion had been around, you know, who had more appointees, the executive branch or the judicial branch. So the amendment is switching it around. So there would still, the balance would still be with one extra appointee coming from the judicial branch and not the executive branch. So
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to this provision, members? Vice Chair Frazier renews his motion to adopt R29, Section 24, with the H0447A9 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. That is adopted. Let's see. Senator Umu Verbaten, do you want to move this one? This is on R32 to R47, adopt the House language in Sections 1 through 4. Then Section 5 is amended by the A61 amendment, and then Sections 6 to 13, 15 to 19, 21 to 29, and Section 31. And this is about the Take Pride Act. Senator Umu Verbaten, would you like to make that motion and then speak to it?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved. Really excited about the Take Pride Act and those important clarifications to the definitions and the Human Rights Act that we're making. This is really important for our LGBTQ plus community. And, you know, I think we've just seen a rise in hate. And it's really, really scary for those of us who are part of our community. I want to thank the Department of Human Rights for all of their work on this and feel really good about where the language is at. So, yes, I'd like to move adoption of those articles.
You don't have to list them all again. members, any discussion to Senator Umu Verbaten's motion? All right. Not seeing any. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and that section is adopted. All right. Next item on the agenda is adoption of Article 13. Article 13 deals with the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, which was a Chair Latz, Chair Becker-Finn bill. Chair Latz, would you like to move to adopt the Senate language in Article 13?
So moved.
All right. Any discussion to adopting the MRRA? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and Article 13 Senate language is adopted. Last item on our agenda for now, adoption of Article 17, which is the controlled substances schedules. Very exciting. Chair Latz, would you like to move adoption of the House language of Article 17?
So moved.
All right. Any discussion to that motion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and Article 17 House language is adopted. So we're gonna recess. There is a lot still happening. We're hoping to still come back today and adopt some more things. So with that, we will be in recess. All right, I'm going to call this meeting back to order. We do not yet have a spreadsheet to share with folks, but we hope that we will very soon. Just a lot of people that, you know, a lot of people have to get together for us to get to this point. So stay tuned for that. We do have a couple policy articles that we're going to go ahead and adopt that we do have agreement on. So the first one we have on the agenda, it is Article 7. So Chair Mueller, would you like to move to adopt reviser number S2909, Article 7, which deals with sentencing? Chair Mueller.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the sentencing article? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to point out the change to the definition of gross misdemeanors from a maximum possible period of imprisonment of 365 days to 364 days. This addresses a very specific issue with a disconnect between our state law and federal immigration law, and this is going to make sure that Minnesota gets to decide what the collateral consequences of a misdemeanor offense are rather than the federal government. So I'm just super excited about it, and I wanted to point it out. I'm very excited to be voting on it today.
And Chair Mueller, if you could
I guess I didn't know that was planned, but if you wanted to walk through what else is in here, that would be great.
No, that was super helpful. And the other items, just for people who maybe don't have this right in front of them, is changing the makeup of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have the bill for prosecutor-initiated resentencing was a bill that I carried and Senator Latz carried. We have a five-year probation cap bill that's in this one, and I believe, and the 364 days that Representative Feist mentioned.
All right. Any further discussion to Article 7? All right. Not seeing any further discussion. All those in favor of adopting Article 7, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 7, as moved by Chair Mueller, is adopted. Next, we have Article 16. Chair Mueller, would you like to move to adopt reviser number S2909, Article 16, having to do with controlled substances? And if you can tell us anything more than that about it, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is my motion. And this controlled substances policy bill contains changes to the fentanyl penalties. I believe, Senator Sieberger, that was your bill. We also have park zone modifications related to tribes. I believe, Chair Becker Finn, that was your bill. Syringe service providers and repealing drug paraphernalia, that was a Representative Gomez bill. And then finally, Narcan training, which was part of the bill related to fentanyl penalties. I believe that was in both the House and the Senate versions.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion to Article 16 as moved by Chair Mueller? All right. All those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and we have adopted Article 16. Last thing we have to move today, Chair Mueller, so this is the tribal law enforcement concurrent jurisdiction section. So, Chair Mueller, would you like to move adoption of the House language in Article 11, Sections 22 through 29? For those with Article 11 in front of them, that's on pages R19 through 22.
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All right. And this... this has been a long time coming, and I know that our tribal communities have been asking for this for a really long time. We did have it in both bills, but we're going to adopt the House language as moved by Chair Mueller. Any further discussion to this provision? All right. All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and that that House language is adopted. That is it. It was very, very. We made you come back. It could have been later. We tried to have more for you, and we will tomorrow. Hopefully, a full day here in conference committee tomorrow. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. We may end up posting the spreadsheet this evening yet, even though we're going to adjourn here. But just stay tuned. We're doing the best we can to get things out and make sure we got everything straight before we post it. Any questions for members? All right. With that, we are adjourned.